don't invade your neighbors and move out of the countries that you've invaded.
Senator Dan Sullivan opposes President Trump's position on Russia's actions. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 16th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Dunleavy gubernatorial campaign comes under fire for using a woman's picture without permission.
The issue of them using me as an image to portray the support of the Native community, I wasn't comfortable with.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Do you want to work at a job that contributes to the health of your community? Well, Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, is hiring. SEARCH offers full-time jobs that include health, vision, and dental benefits, as well as paid time off and retirement savings. For more information, visit search.org/jobs and view open positions. Start a rewarding career helping others at SEARCH. Healthy is here. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
Both of Alaska's Republican U.S. senators are taking issue with President Trump's remarks in Helsinki today. Trump, standing beside Russian President Vladimir Putin, wouldn't say whether he believes the U.S. intelligence agency assessment that Russia meddled in the 2016 election.
I have great confidence in my intelligence people, but I will tell you that President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today.
Senator Lisa Murkowski, in a written statement, said she was stunned that Trump didn't take the opportunity at the press conference to confront Putin. She says Trump instead validated the Russian leader by giving credence to his denial of involvement. In his own written statement, Senator Dan Sullivan said he disagrees with President Trump's remarks in Helsinki. Sullivan says the U.S. intelligence community is obviously more credible than Putin, whom Sullivan called a mafia regime leader. In a tweet on Sunday before the Helsinki summit, Trump put the blame for the poor U.S.-Russia relationship on what he called U.S. stupidity and the ongoing investigation into the 2016 election. Special Counsel Robert Mueller is investigating whether Russia interfered with the election and whether any Americans helped. Sullivan, though, said it's up to Russia to improve the relationship.
Don't invade your neighbors and move out of the countries that you've invaded. Don't align yourself with the world's biggest sponsor of state terrorism in terms of Iran. Don't back regimes like Bashar al-Assad. And certainly don't meddle in the elections of democracies like the United States.
So what you're saying is you...
Sullivan spoke Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press. Alaska's Gasline Corporation is planning to hire a private contractor to help it through the federal permitting process. The move comes after the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission sent a letter to the state asking for help. That commission is the federal agency doing the environmental and engineering review of the Alaska LNG project. Frank Richards is the senior vice president of the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation. He says the federal commission is short-staffed and they're looking to outsource some of the project review they usually do in-house.
In this case, it is for the fire protection review. And that's essentially examining the engineering plans and drawings that we've provided to them to make sure that they're in compliance with code and good engineering practices.
Last week, Bloomberg News reported a backlog of permit reviews at the Federal Commission, citing delays of up to 12 to 18 months. But Richard says he met with staff from the Federal Commission and didn't say there would be any delays in the schedule for permitting Alaska's project. Currently, Alaska's Gasline project is on an 18-month timeline to get through the environmental review. That schedule would see a final environmental review of the project by late 2019. A Fairbanks woman objected to a video of her being included in a campaign advertisement without her consent. Republican candidate for Governor Mike Dunleavy's campaign removed the footage soon after it became aware of her concern. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports the woman says the ad took advantage of her Inupiaq ethnicity.
Marjorie Tabon says she became aware of the ad on social media when friends forwarded it to her. She says that in the original version of the ad, there is a few seconds of her walking in the woods and of her dancing as part of a group.
It's just my face, and it obviously my face, and I'm obviously a brown person, and I'm obviously Native in there. And so the issue of them using me as an image to portray the support of the Native community, I wasn't comfortable with.
She criticized the ad in a Facebook post, saying that she doesn't support Dunleavy. The campaign took down the ad on Sunday, shortly after it became aware of the post. The ad's been reposted without the footage of Ta-Bone. Ta-Bone works to provide Inuit tattoos to women. She lives in Fairbanks and is originally from Nome. She says Dunleavy's campaign may have had the right to use the footage, but should have asked her before doing it.
They made a huge mistake by just using me, using my face, without my permission.
Dunleavy campaign manager Brett Huber says the use of footage from an AJ Plus news video was typical for campaign ads. AJ Plus is part of the Al Jazeera media network.
We saw the comments posted on Facebook, so we took swift action to remove the image. I sent a message to Marjorie explaining to her while the footage was obtained and used legally, we didn't want anybody to include an ad that they didn't support.
Huber says Dunleavy wouldn't seek to use the image of an Alaska Native woman to convey support from Natives. He noted that Dunleavy's wife, Rose, is an Alaska Native.
One of the things I like the most about our candidate is he's colorblind and he's genderblind. Mike's been married to an Alaska Native woman for 31 years. He would never advantage specifically an Alaska Native, a Caucasian, or any other race. People are people. So certainly that was never our intent, nor would it be something that Mike would pursue.
Dunleavy resigned from his state Senate seat in January to focus on his campaign. He previously served as a teacher and school superintendent in Kotzebue. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an investigation into the sinking of a crab boat reveals it was weighed down by ice.
So if you look at that probable cause, yes, this is a preventable accident.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. And by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
A crab boat that sank in the Bering Sea last winter likely capsized after the vessel became coated in hundreds of thousands of pounds of ice. That's the conclusion of a report released last week by federal investigators. As KUCB's Laura Craigle reports, the findings shed new light on the loss of the FV Destination and its six crew members.
On February 11, 2017, the Destination was pushing through rough, frigid waters a few miles from St. George Island. Then, in about 4 minutes, the boat went from carrying 200 crab pots and preparing for a paleo season to vanishing without a mayday call.
Whatever happened, happened very, very quickly, and there's no one left to tell their story.
Chris O'Neill is a spokesperson for the National Transportation Safety Board. He says NTSB investigators reviewed the vessel's mechanical history, pored over weather reports, and interviewed almost 50 people to piece together the probable cause of the accident.
The captain's decision to proceed into heavy freezing spray conditions without ensuring the Destination had a margin of stability to withstand that accumulation of ice led to the loss of the vessel.
In better conditions, O'Neill says the boat could have carried the 200 crab pots without a problem. But with gale force winds kicking up freezing spray, the Destination became weighed down by as many as 340,000 pounds of ice.
So if you look at that probable cause, yes, this is a preventable accident.
With no survivors to interview, O'Neill says NTSB couldn't determine why the crew didn't beat more ice to mitigate that weight, especially a well-respected crew with more than 70 years of collective fishing experience.
Very hard to know with certainty the mindset, the decision-making process, and what factors were or were not considered. But certainly through the evidence that was collected throughout the investigation, we recognize the pressures that are associated with the industry.
Investigators found several signs that the crew was feeling the pressure of time. The vessel had gotten a late start on crab after fishing for cod. Its delivery deadline was looming, and a few weeks earlier, a crew member had texted his father, "Oh my God, I haven't slept in days." The strains of commercial fishing are familiar to Dyer George. He's captain of the FV Polar Sea, which was fishing for crab in the same area as the destination the day it went down.
The whole crew was exhausted. I was beating ice with my crew.
They pulled into port safely after hours spent heaving sledgehammers to break ice. But in an interview weeks later, George said the destination's sinking was a wake-up call for the entire fleet.
And it's devastating. They say what? The most accidents happened 10 minutes from home. I mean, he was so close to St. Paul. He was in St. George. He could have anchored up there and wait for daylight and get some ice off the boat. We are no need to rush as much. You know, we're going to catch the crab. So why are we going to push that hard?
In a fishery that's made huge safety strides in the last two decades, U.S. Coast Guard officials say crabbers have taken the sinking to heart. Almost 50 boats participated in a voluntary safety check last year to review their stability criteria, and there were no fatalities in this winter crab season. The loss of the destination marks the fleet's deadliest accident since 2005. In Unalaska, I'm Laura Craigle.
The Iditarod has expanded its governing board. On Monday, the organization announced it has added 4 new members to its board. The move comes as a response to growing criticism of the race leadership team. The new members are Nina Kemple, Karen King, Mike Mills, and Ryan York. Unlike many of the ITC's current board members, none are Iditarod race veterans, and there are no apparent conflicts of interest. The move is partially a response to concerns that nepotism and cozy relationships were guiding board decisions on controversial changes in recent years. The restructured board leaves 10 members total, with 3 people departing: Rick Swenson, Aaron Burmeister, and Wade Mars, all of whom are current or former Iditarod mushers. Last year, the Iditarod was beset with different scandals, including high-profile allegations of doping, withdrawal of major sponsors, and calls from mushers for the ITC board chair to resign. Requests for comment to Iditarod CEO and media spokesman were not returned by this afternoon. The Alaska Army National Guard is handing over ownership of more than 60 armories in rural communities, mostly to municipalities.
Many of these places have sat vacant for some time.
That's Brian Duffy. He's with the Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. He says the reason the training and storage facilities were there in the first place was the Alaska Army National Guard's scout mission.
So imagine people out in remote locations, and they were our sensors, and they would report things that they saw, felt, or heard that were different than what they normally observe day to day.
But the Alaska Army National Guard has since restructured its forces, and its numbers have fallen since the 1990s. So they no longer do much with the dozens of armories in communities across the state. Now, Duffy says, as part of a larger right-sizing initiative, they want to see the facilities put to better use.
We take a building and maybe some other property on the land in which it sits and, you know, put it in the hands of an organization that can better use it than we can at this time.
He says that involves a lot of work to survey the properties, make sure they're safe and not contaminated, figure out what exact entity owns them, and then complete the handover. So far, 15 armories have been divested, including Norvik and Kayana in the Northwest Arctic Borough. More than 35 are scheduled for the process within the next 4 years, including most communities in the Norton Sound and Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta regions. According to Duffy, Nome's Armory is among 18 that the Alaska Army National Guard is keeping. He says, in general, the effort will save the National Guard some money, but
honestly, what we feel better about is putting these buildings in the hands of people that can use them rather than us having them sit there vacant.
As for what they'll become, the buildings often have the space and infrastructure to house community centers of some kind. In one case, Kwithluk hoped to turn its armory into a teen center. So even as the Alaska Army National Guard is campaigning to expand its presence in rural Alaska and recruit more Alaska Native soldiers, it'll be doing so without all of its armories. A commercial company that aims to launch small payloads into the Earth's orbit is conducting tests for a future launch from Alaska Aerospace Corporation's facility at Narrow Cape. They're trying to develop a streamlined rocket or vehicle to carry small payloads. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche recently visited the site where the employees of the company Vector are conducting tests with a simulation rocket called a Pathfinder.
Pacific Spaceport Complex Facilities Director Bruce Walter enters what looks like a locker room. It's important that no dust gets through.
This is where you would don your white robe, if you will, booties, pants, hoods, and you'd walk through the air bath, which is just a big air jacuzzi. Gets all the dust off of you. HEPA filters at the bottom to take the particles out. And then you step into the clean room.
What's known as the clean room is big and well lit. The ceiling is so high that it dwarfs anyone that enters. It's like a cathedral, but for spaceships. This building is where staff prepares satellites, also known as payloads, for launch. What looks like a rocket is set up on one side of the room. It's dark gray with orange lettering along the side reading Vector. The company says it's 43 feet long and 42 inches wide. Walter explains it's a test model.
They're going through the steps to make sure that all of their procedures work with the real vehicle. This is, again, it's a mock-up. If you look in the back end of it, it's just a big empty tube.
John Garvey, president of Launch Services for Vector, says the exercises this week are part of a test run. They're focusing on the operations, like moving the vehicle around.
And we're just trying to establish that as the basis so that when we move up to the next level, issues like transporting it, picking it up, erecting it vertical will already have been accepted as normal, so we can start working on the next level of functions.
He says they were out at the facility on Tuesday and continued with exercises today. In Kodiak, I'm Kayla DeRoche for KMXT.
Usibelli Coal Mine is celebrating its 75th anniversary. The operation in Healy, started by Emil Usibelli in 1943 and run by his son and now grandson, is Alaska's only operating coal mine. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Joe Usibelli has run the company for the last three decades and shared the story of the family mine in a recent presentation to the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce. Usibelli says his family came to the U.S. over 100 years ago to seek a better life, just like today's immigrants.
My great-grandfather came over in 1907. My grandfather came over in 1909. They came from Italy. And there's parallel in the world right now.
Usibelli says his grandfather worked numerous jobs along the West Coast, eventually coming to Alaska and later starting a coal mine to supply the Army as the military built up in Alaska for World War II.
The original customer was Ladd Army Airfield, which is now Fort Wainwright.
The Usibelli mine continues to provide coal for interior military and public power generation. For a time, the mine exported coal outside Alaska until changing world markets made it uneconomic.
We've had trials and tribulations. We continue. Every business does. Every business has that. But you need to learn from it. You need to get through it.
Usibelli attributes the family mine's long-term success to a few basic elements.
Working hard, having tenacity, having a bit of luck.
While power generation has shifted to natural gas in many places outside, Usibelli remains optimistic about coal's future in Alaska, noting renovation of a second Golden Valley Electric Association coal-fired plant in Healy and the University of Alaska Fairbanks replacement of its old power plant with a state-of-the-art coal-burning facility.
The new university plant is getting ready to start up here in just the next few weeks, and those are our future.
The Usibelli Mine is holding a 75th anniversary open house and reception at the mine site in Healy, Saturday, August 4th. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
There's a new type of bank open in South Central Alaska that's aiming to help people across the state stay in their homes and build new businesses. The Kinnick Tribal Council is offering loans to people who aren't normally eligible to borrow money. It's a model that's already strengthening communities in Southeast Alaska, and it relies on relationships. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman brings you this story from the Solutions Desk.
Let's say you want to start a business or buy a house. You'll probably need a loan from a bank. That means you'll need a good credit history or collateral, something to prove that you'll pay it back. But if that's not an option, then what? Welcome to a Community Development Financial Institution, or CDFI. It's like a bank with a mission to help the community. It relies on relationships.
Instead of lending money to what the numbers are, lend money to the person.
That's Richard Porter, the executive director of the Kinnick Tribal Council, which recently opened its own CDFI. This flexible financial organization has a pool of money from government, private, and nonprofit sources that can be lent to people who wouldn't be eligible for a traditional loan or who would get really high interest rates. The whole point of the program is to offer financial opportunities in low-income communities.
You know as well as I do, when you try to go get a loan and your credit's bad, well, guess what? You pay 20, 25% on the dollar. And how does that work out? Does that help you get ahead? Does that help you move forward in your financial situation to where you can actually start to begin to create wealth after home ownership?
One of those people Kinnick Tribal Council might eventually lend money to is Ayuman Moses. But before she can even ask for help with a housing loan, she must first attend a financial literacy class.
How about any other places to save?
About a dozen people, including a baby, sit in the classroom at the tribal office discussing building a budget and putting aside money each month. They share ideas about ways to spend less on food and phone apps that offer good deals. After the two-hour-long class, participants stay to talk to the teacher, and Moses reflects on what she learned.
This class is really exciting, and it's like, it's really, really opened my eyes, and it's helped me to realize the things I need to do to make the changes, to make positive changes for me and my girls.
Moses says she recently separated from her husband, and her financial situation is drastically different than it used to be. She knows she needs to be financially stable before reaching for one of her biggest goals.
I eventually want to own my house. That's one of my goals. That's one of the things I have on my wall. I made a list of what I want in my life.
She hopes to eventually get a loan from the tribe, which started developing its lending program 3 years ago and is just now giving out housing loans. They are the only statewide organization of its type, and at least half of their clients need to be Alaska Native or American Indian, but anyone can apply. Porter says one of their primary goals is to make it possible for people to keep living and working in rural areas instead of migrating to the Mat-Su borough.
They end up here and they end up costing our system a lot of money if they don't want to be here. So we're interested, if they want to stay out in the village, that we can help them accomplish that.
One regional financing group has already shown that the flexible community development tool is an effective solution for rural Alaska, where traditional banks don't often have branches. Spruce Root started in southeast Alaska 6 years ago. Paul Hackenmuller is their business development director. He says so far, they've only given out a dozen loans totaling about $800,000, though the number of proposals is growing. But Hackenmuller says success isn't just measured by the number of loans. As the name says, a CDFI is aimed at community development, which means developing long-term capacity. At the Kinnick Tribal Council, that means teaching financial literacy. At Spruce Root, they work with entrepreneurs in seven small southeast communities to develop business plans. After going through the process, some of their clients realize they can start their businesses without any help. Others figure they shouldn't even bother trying for a loan.
Sometimes you work with an entrepreneur and they realize, wait a minute, this business will never make me money. So I'm going to stop today after going through this business planning process and not spend the next 2 or 3 years of my life and who knows how many thousands of dollars trying to run a business that will cost me money every time I open the door.
Ultimately, Spruce Root's goal is similar to Kinnick Tribe's goal, to help people thrive in their home communities and not have to relocate.
The focus has always been on strengthening rural economies here so that the people who have lived here, who live here now and have lived here and thrived for thousands of years, you know, can continue to do so.
Both Spruce Root and Kinnick Tribe think offering a flexible financial tool that depends on relationships instead of numbers helps level the economic playing field so that people can do just that. For the Solutions Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
For Alaskans trying to purchase the latest Air Jordans or the styles they see in a Drake music video, there really aren't a lot of local options. A young Anchorage entrepreneur wants to change that. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early spoke with the owner of a new store looking to be the first in the state to specialize in high-end urban streetwear.
Devin Jackson knew as early as kindergarten he wanted to be a businessman when he grew up.
I started out just doing like elite socks in my garage, spray painting them, selling them to my friends in middle school. And we started to grow. We were Team Elite 907 back then. Man, that was a long time ago.
6 years is a long time when you're 17. Jackson's latest business venture is League, a brand new store at Anchorage's Diamond Mall, the largest mall in the state. On opening day, about 8 customers are in the store, pouring through hangers with flashy hoodies and checking out the extensive sneaker display. For a small lease space in the mall, it's kind of packed. Jackson says he hopes the store will serve a unique niche in the state.
What Alaska has really been craving is a good streetwear brand. And we decided that we were going to be the ones to don that. That was our thing.
The selection ranges from local art to racks of vintage attire. Jackson says he stocked the old school collection through consignment and thrifting. But he says the main draw of League is the high-end stuff.
Super, super high-end, almost impossible to get clothing items. I mean, a regular hoodie could go for almost $400. A pair of shorts could go for $300. You never know. So I would say that we have anything that you can't get. Let's keep it simple.
Jackson just graduated from West Anchorage High School. He says he's the first black store owner at the Diamond Mall, and he thinks he might be the youngest store owner in the state. Jackson says he made efforts to talk to business owners from around town about the nitty-gritty points of running a store. He says he raised all the money for the store through fundraisers in the community. He didn't have to travel too far to get advice.
Somebody who has helped me a lot is my dad, because he owned a business for over 20 years. He's helped me. He's in here helping me right now.
Devin Jackson doesn't have any paid employees yet, just volunteer help. Eric Jackson, Devin's father, is helping put up a sign decal on the window.
Ever since he's been old enough to talk, always dream of owning his own business, have a desire to be great business owner. He can take just about anything and turn it around for his favor, so he's got that gift, I guess.
Devin is going to Southern Wesleyan University in South Carolina in the fall, where he plans to play basketball and major in business administration. And he has big ambitions.
And I feel like League is something small, but absolutely something big as well. But it's just the first step into, you know, growing my enterprise, really.
And just because he'll be thousands of miles away, that doesn't mean Jackson won't be keeping close tabs on his business.
With technology now, it's really not going to be too hard. I have, you know, control and vision over almost everything.
Devin says his 6-month plan is for League to be sustainable so he can look to his next venture. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Rasha McChesney and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Laura Craigle in Unalaska, Zachariah Hughes and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Gabe Colombo in Nome, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.